J.G. Ballard, Kingdom Come, 2006. The voice that narrates Kingdom Come is that of Richard Pearson, an advertising man who has just lost both his job and his father. The father was the victim of an apparently random shooting at a huge shopping center in Brooklands, between Weybridge and Woking. Pearson goes there to close down the flat and seek some post-mortem understanding of the father he hardly knew. On the way, he runs into various signs of racial unrest, and in Brooklands itself, described as a pleasant terrain of comfortable houses, stylish office buildings, and retail parks, every advertising man's image of Britain in the 21st century, he finds his father's death to be involved in ambiguities, and the town a hotbed of racial prejudice and hooliganism, led by men wearing shirts with the St. George's cross. All is not well in the pleasant terrain. Not surprisingly, given his profession, but perhaps unfortunately for the reader, Pearson's narration is so thoroughly unreliable that his story is difficult to follow, and inconsistent sometimes to the point of self-destruction. It's often hard to read his judgments and descriptions as anything but symptoms of hysteria or paranoia, though he often writes with a specious brilliance, as when he shows us a commentator on a giant screen, his smile dying in the blur of arc lights, authentic in his insincerity. Everyone he meets talks pretty much the way he does. Here is a middle-aged solicitor describing life in Brooklands, where he grew up. No one attends church. Why bother? They find spiritual fulfillment at the New Age Center, first left after the burger bar. We had a dozen societies and clubs, music, amateur dramatics, archaeology. They shut down long ago. Charities, political parties, no one turns up. At Christmas, the Metro Center hires a fleet of motorized Santas. They cruise the streets, blaring out tapes of Disney carols. Checkout girls dressed up as Tinkerbell flashing their thighs. A Panzer Army putting on its cutest show. To which Pearson replies, "Rather like the rest of England. Does it matter?" This hateful, scornful exaggeration, coupled with the affectless response, is characteristic of the tone throughout. Pearson seems to side against effete London with the dwellers in the interurban sprawl, the consumers to whom his advertising was directed, the real England. Yet his judgment of them is brutally snobbish. They preferred lies and mood music. The Heathrow suburbs are a zoo for psychopaths. This well represents an advertiser's bimodal thinking, but the hysterical note keeps sounding as he repeatedly presents his perception of Londoners and the people of the motorway towns as two equally degenerate species, seething with mutual loathing and contempt. As he sees them, the people of Brooklands, the paradise of consumerism, have nothing to do but consume, and their consumerism is consummate. So they are bored, on the edge, longing for violence, even for madness, anything for a thrill. Hence the popularity of the bully boys wearing the cross of St. George. These faceless multitudes, whose life is shopping and spectator sport, are ripe for fascism. Along in here I thought of José Saramago's The Cave, which is also about a monstrous supermall. A consumerist apotheosis, but one even more sinister than the Metro Center, because at least some of the people it destroys are seen as human beings. They retain, as long as they can, a daily life of hard work and strong emotional bonds, and through it access to the spiritual. Saramago quotes Plato as his epigraph, "What a strange scene you describe, and what strange prisoners! They are just like us." J.G. Ballard's motive in writing Kingdom Come may have been much akin to Saramago's in The Cave, But Ballard's narrator is inadequate. He himself has no access to work worth doing or any bond but sex. He is totally alienated. He can see the people of Brooklands only as parodies of himself. Work and family mean nothing to him or them. Consumerism itself is, he tells us repeatedly, their religion. So the dome of the Metro Center becomes their temple, where they fall to worshipping giant teddy bears, a scene which strains both sympathy and credulity, yet is so portentous in tone as to subvert its comic potential. In a novel, particularly in a science fiction novel, if you're expecting an apocalypse, you're probably going to get one. Richard Pearson connives in a mini-revolution, a manufactured local outbreak of irrationality, violence, and warped spiritual fervor. The leaders of this movement barricade themselves with a few thousand hapless shopper hostages in the great dome of the Metro Center and withstand for 2 months the government's somewhat perfunctory efforts to unseat or outwait them. All this last section of the book moves with energy through scenes of surreal vividness. As the siege goes on, as the food in the meat markets and greengrocers rots, and the air conditioning is shut off, and the water gives out, the gradual and literal decay of existence inside the huge dome is brilliantly drawn. The narrator comes alive as everything begins dying. No doubt it's what he's been waiting for all along. After the siege, as violence and racist attacks die down, and the television reverts to household hints and book group discussions, Pearson tells us, once people began to talk earnestly about the novel, any hope of freedom had died. Yet a page later, the last sentence of the book is, in time, unless the sane woke and rallied themselves, an even fiercer republic would open the doors and spin the turnstiles of its beckoning paradise. The meanings of the words freedom, sanity, and republic are here so compromised as to be meaningless. To this narrator, nothing actually means anything. Nothing is what it is. But the trouble with letting a spin doctor tell your story is that you risk your reader asking him his own question. Does it matter?